Suncast is proudly supported by Trina Solar.
A lot of hardware companies, the way to get their products deployed into homeowners is through a network of installers. And the process in which they do that, they manage the installers, they manage that installation, is still quite immature and not standardized. For some larger companies out there, they have the resources to build in-house fancy software to be able to manage that and support that process. But for a lot of OEMs, they don't have that. We're here to help standardize and make it super easy for those manufacturers to deploy standardized processes and onboard an installer network to do that reliably every time.
Hey there, Solar Warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in and welcome to our tribe. Hey, welcome back, Solar Warriors. And if you're new to the show, welcome in. I just want to say thanks for lending us the only non-renewable resource you've got. That's your time. I promise we're going to take good care of it, because today we're going to dig into a topic that I hope will help you along your journey, whether that's getting into the clean energy space or growing your own business or career. We're here for you, providing the tools, tips, tricks, and the actual trade of how to grow this clean energy revolution. Today's entrepreneur left the world of high finance to pursue her dreams of starting a company. She did that with one of her childhood best friends, and the result is they're serving tens of thousands of customers in rural Myanmar. They birthed a software platform that won a DOE Solar Prize, among many other accolades and prize monies. We actually had Sierra Fun on the show back when she won the DOE Solar Prize to talk about the product. We'll link to that in the show notes, but today we're going to go much deeper, not just on how the product has evolved since then, but the backstory and how this longtime entrepreneur in waiting has turned her childhood dreams into her actual job. She's the co-founder and CEO of a company called Ilu that we've been talking about, providing software solutions for OEMs in the solar and energy storage sectors to easily onboard and manage their installer networks. It's kind of what you'd imagine all the others having if they had something like a Tesla Pro app. We're going to dig into why that is a business that could be way more profitable than you could imagine, or where the idea came from. I do hope that before we dig in here, you'll take a moment and subscribe to the show if you haven't already. That's how you will ensure that you won't miss out on the twice weekly content just like this each and every week. Clean energy founders and leaders on the front lines of the energy transition. Got more than 680 such episodes. You can find the back catalog in your podcast player of choice or over at mysuncast.com, where we link to a whole lot of other resources that we find each and every week in our conversations with leaders like Sierra Fan. For now, let's get ready to tune up your skills, Solar Warrior, as we tune into another powerful conversation here on Suncast. So you are actually in the heart of Silicon Valley, grew up there. You are in community day to day, where I imagine you're meeting new people and you often have to describe kind of who you are and what you're about. How do you describe at a macro level the problem that you've created Ilu to solve?
I think the problem is there's a lot of hardware companies that the way to get their products deployed into homeowners and to their end customers is through a network of installers. Mm-hmm. And the process in which they do that, they manage the installers, they manage that installation and commissioning, is still quite immature and ad hoc and not standardized. And for some larger companies out there, they have the resources to build in-house, you know, fancy software to be able to manage that and support that process. But for a lot of OEMs, they don't have that. We're here to help standardize and make it super easy for those manufacturers to deploy standardized processes and onboard an installer network to do that reliably every time.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because as I mentioned in the outset, you know, one of the sort of standards in the industry, and I've heard a lot of folks refer to this, is, you know, the Tesla Pro app. It's sort of as a all-in-one simple walkthrough process such that they, Tesla, know that any installer touching their power wall is going to do it the same way every time. It's reliable and it tracks back to their customer journey. It tracks back to their ability to honor warranties and like actually track whether or not the correct workmanship was done for the workmanship warranty. Stuff that's often taken for granted in an industry that is trying to get past the precipice and cross the chasm and get this technology into more hands. Well, with that in mind, introduce us briefly, and we will go into much more depth, but would you give us a brief introduction to ILU and how and why your business is going to help solve the problem you've just enunciated?
ILU is a software platform for manufacturers where they can build any custom process that they need their installers to do on our web app, and that goes directly to their installer network through a mobile app that they don't have to code from scratch, and will have all the custom workflows they need for installers to follow reliably and take photos and data and track where they are.
It's like a software version of the owner's manual.
It's a software version of the owner's manual that also actually verifies and collects information. So not just teaches, but also, you know, tracks how things are going.
Yeah.
And the key thing is that that data is very powerful, right?
Yeah.
The data, you actually know what's going on. You can analyze which of your products are doing well. You can analyze what the pitfalls are that you can focus on and teach. You can see which installers are doing great and that you should develop more out as kind of high value partners. So, yeah.
It reminds me, you're in Silicon Valley. Do you know Process Street? Process Street, the app, the software?
No, I don't.
So it came out, gosh, 2016 or 17 as a checklist app. And now it's like a checklist app on steroids because you can develop checklists around everything and you can make it sequential and you can require, you know, you can make it basically provision a workflow inside of a software company the way that you'd provision a workflow for a product being installed in the home, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it allows, you know, every, you know, folks from podcasters to, you know, software development to have a process that everyone can align on that's baked and that only gets changed and it gets changed within a construct that provides visibility into it, right?
Yeah.
And it also can, and which translates any changes, updates, et cetera, across an entire team and across the library and across time, right?
Yeah.
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 So that's what came to mind when you started sharing kind of the underlying purpose of the product.
Yeah, I think it is really interesting. I think there's so many software tools built for, you know, white collar or even just desk kind of rooted workers, especially in software. There's all kinds of tools that make our lives easier. And speaking as a, in particular for SaaS startups, there's, you know, so many tools that we pull, whether that's Stripe, right, for payments or whatever it is that, that lets us, you know, jumpstart or shortcut all these things so we don't have to build it. That hasn't really happened as much for hardware and deskless workers and kind of people in the field.
Yeah.
In a way that has really lagged probably 20 years. And
it's,
I think that's, you know, just as important and the same rationale applies.
It's,
and
it
can
true.
Have the same kind of,
It makes me laugh because I was reading, I've just recently upgraded to a new phone and I was looking, and it's sort of an interesting sort of cross analogy, but it is what popped to mind. I was looking, do I need a screen protector on my phone? And everybody was like, yeah, no, you don't need a screen protector. These phones are Gorilla Glass. They're amazing. And somebody came in and was like, you must work in a pillow factory. I work in the real world where my phone, I have not only a case, but a cover and another cover because concrete and rocks and dirt.
Yeah.
And I thought it's so true. Like most of these forums are dominated by white collar workers who would never even sit their phone down except in their pocket or their purse. So it's an interesting, you referred to it as deskless jobs. And I think that's really apropos. What, as you surveyed the landscape, to decide, is this thing that we've created for our customers useful in the real world outside of our sort of microcosm? What solutions were available to the theoretical customer at that moment?
Well, there's two sides of it. There's, you know, we did go through that process when we were in Myanmar, looking for software solutions, being like, there must be things out here to help with the particular challenges that we're facing. And we really went through quite a bit of them, right? In terms of project management softwares, there's quite a lot. There's a lot, you know, for kind of desk workers that we tried, whether that's, you know, Asana or Monday or these things, but they're really not. I think this is one of these things. There's a lot of small UI UX decisions that go into those things that make it more fit for someone who's going to be in front of their computer for most of the day, that made it hard to use on the field. Another one that we see is, you know, Salesforce, field service that is built for people out in the field.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is it gets so clunky and complicated, and the on ramp to using something like that is such an investment that, you know, that became difficult for us to justify with our field teams. And the main design strategy that we've used has been kind of informed to be almost the opposite of that. What's something that's, you know, installer can just get their app or scan a QR code and get taken to, and they don't need to learn how to do it because it's so obvious. They're swiping through each step. They're told very clearly, right, through not just words, but design, what they need to do on each step. We are really designing something that doesn't need someone to sit through a training webinar to learn how to use that.
Yeah, that's what's coming to mind for me. Yeah, it's interesting. Because for anyone who was a listener back in 2022, when we did the original interview with you, it was the same contest where other recent guests were also awarded on the software side, an AMC Solar Prize, the folks from Heliovolta. So we just had James and David on. I know that you guys have become great friends since then as well, because a lot of folks would look at the two companies and go, wait, why aren't you guys doing sort of the same thing? And what I've come to understand is what SolarGrade, James and David's core product with Heliovolta is for asset owners, right? It's they like to call it the SolarFax, the Carfax for operating assets. And what you are focused on, so they're at the end of the project being installed, the actual upkeep of like creating a score for that product. So that the asset, which you can appreciate from your finance days, the asset, the finance folks can wrap their heads around the actual real value, and there's resale value, and there's they can better understand the asset and its performance. Whereas you guys are coming in at the very beginning of the cycle before hands have ever touched the product, and in a way disrupting the need for, as you said, customer orientation webinars, the need for physical manuals, et cetera, right? Things that would get outdated pretty quickly and can be updated in real time through software. That's fascinating. What do you feel like needed to be true in order for the timing of ILU right now to be appropriate? You know, if you look 5, 10, 15 years, this would definitely not have worked when I started my company in 2006.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things. There's the kind of widespread ownership and use of smartphones. I think that's very critical. And I think, you know, we think about it a little bit almost like Google Maps, what Google Maps did to directions, where now you have this vehicle to get key information that is informed by kind of the context of who is doing it, where they are, what equipment is being installed, that you can just give that step-by-step instruction similar to, you know, the way Google Maps kind of revolutionized that. So definitely, you know, the widespread availability of smartphones. I think the second one is I see a change in solar and storage into more modularized devices. And I think the work for these technicians is now a bit different. They're no longer electricians that are kind of calculating and trying to, you know, figure out on the field, in the field, what needs to be done. It's very much here is the particular device that needs to be installed. And it becomes a much more prescriptive process how you're supposed to work with that device. And also, you know, sometimes a more finicky process because you're dealing with the particularities of a particular, of this product versus a previous model versus, you know, someone else's inverter that all has, you know, the dip switch settings need to be set in this particular way that you can't work out from first principles. So that's, I think, another factor that has really driven the need for something like this. And I think, you know, the other thing is a bit similar to that, but also, you know, the fact that our energy infrastructure is becoming much more distributed. So instead of having a large centralized project where you have a supervisor who can answer questions and can be there to support, a lot of times you have a kind of two-person crew on the field somewhere, and it's you rely more on this information being available and this data collected because that manufacturer or the asset owner or the homeowner will most likely not be there to see what's happening. And you need to collect that, present the instructions and collect that information for future reference.
I hadn't thought about that. There's the way that things were done. There's a lot of kind of, I'll call it tribal knowledge and centralized knowledge. So you've got a foreman or a project manager who the crew knows is going to stop by at some point. So they run into a roadblock, they're going to ask the foreman. And as we have more optimization around crews, because the product is more standardized, it requires a different methodology for ensuring quality control in the field. Yeah, that's really fascinating. So it's apparent from the conversation that your clients who you sell to, how you make money, are OEMs. Are there other additional prospective or existing clients that you are, that this software serves?
Yeah, it's actually a bit of a two-pronged revenue model. So we sell to OEMs, and not just OEMs, you know, we sell to people who care about a specific process being followed on the field. And most of the time that's OEMs because, you know, they care, it's their product, they know what the process should be. But that could be extrapolated to other organizations.
Thanks.
And, you know, when we started out in Myanmar, we worked with DGRV, a big German development agency that funded and managed many microgrids across Myanmar. And they cared about those microgrids being, you know, taken care of and upkept and inspected in a standardized way. So they played that role of what we call workflow creator that, you know, most of the time for us manufacturers play, and they would be a client for us. And we also see this for kind of government organizations that's doing a full on, say, kind of inspection. They have lots of facility managers. They have lots of systems across the US. They're trying to implement a standardized process. They would also be a workflow creator. So that's one set, and we kind of lump them together. Mostly manufacturers, also some other parties. These are workflow creators. That's the main client that, you know, I'm talking to, we're talking to, and establishing kind of a close relationship and partnership with. We do also work directly with the installers, and we have installers that are on our platform standalone, but usually the model is actually the manufacturer, the OEM brings us in, they provide the app to their installers. As part of that, the installers get for free a set of features in our app that allows them to, you know, see this OEM's workflows, be able to execute them and follow them. But these installers also, you know, can find this information and data and this type of platform helpful. And we would also kind of upsell to these installers, and they can actually use this as a project management platform. So their dispatcher can use this to assign different jobs. They can see the workflow and data that's coming in. We have data, we have report generation tools. So when they fill out these processes and follow them and take photos, it generates a report that they can then share with, you know, the homeowner or whoever else that they're accountable to. So it is two-pronged in that way.
And so if the OEM is workflow creator, government org or dev agency, does that make the installer a workflow consumer?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, we usually just call them installer or team, but they are okay. Workflow consumer, workflow executor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, one of the questions that we touched on when I was first trying to wrap my head around this with you is, it seems to me that as a workflow consumer, if I'm an installer in here in North Carolina, I'm buying from a distributor. I'm probably installing various OEM solar modules. I'm installing not just Solark and SMA, but also maybe two other types of inverters, and also maybe three or four different types of battery storage, depending on what's available. And frankly, where I have capacity for finance and what's on the shelf at the time, right? How does the product lend itself to an installer being able to use multiple workflows from different vendors?
I think that's, you know, one of the things that we're trying to replace, and I think we can do better and provide a better experience to installers, is that these workflows are now all through or built on the Elu app and in a kind of standard format through the Elu app. And you can actually attach workflows from different OEMs within the same, what we call job, which is a site visit. So you can stack them up. As an installer, now you have the record that, you know, person A went to kind of this home on this day and did all of these things. Some of these, you know, here's the inverter commissioning workflow. Here's the battery commissioning workflow. And so you have the full context of that within the same app instead of having to, you know, toggle between a bunch of different apps, like, you know, the Tesla one and whichever else that you all have on your phone separately. And each one of them does things slightly differently. And it's hard to combine, say, the photos from that you took into one with the other. I think that's, you know, something that we also kind of learned from experience and wanted to avoid. And we're very much working on, you know, bagging or getting the largest OEMs onto our platform to make that as easy as possible for installers. And I think there'll be some momentum there as we go.
Who do you see? You mentioned traditional workflow technology, Salesforce, Asana, ClickUp, et cetera. And there are certainly like field service software that are popular for project management across the board. Are there any other, who do you consider to be competitors specifically in the energy or in the clean energy or directly in the solar sector?
I think we sit across functionalities that you would otherwise have to kind of tack on in different ways.
Uh-huh.
I think, or through different platforms. I think none of these is a super direct competitor. If anything, I think our main competition, at least from the OEM side, is them deciding to build something bespoke in house. I think that is the main alternative pathway to achieve this that we are, you know, competing against.
I mean, if you and I are sitting in a meeting with an OEM, and they said, well, we have a pretty crack smart team internally. Why wouldn't we just build it ourselves? What would your answer be?
I think that there's a couple of reasons. One, we'll be much cheaper for them to use us than paying for a lot of software developers. Two, there's quite a bit of software that OEMs need to build in-house or are basically required to build in-house. And that's all the asset-facing monitoring type of software. So, you know, if you're a kind of inverter company, you usually have some kind of monitoring platform that you're providing to the homeowners that you have to build in-house. And that, you know, is rarely something that gets kind of fully outsourced into a SaaS-type platform because it, you know, very much touches the way, you know, your product works. And I think the main thing we provide is for things that don't need to be built in-house, you can take us and a shortcut, basically a shortcut, same way that we use Stripe or kind of the other low-code platforms that I mentioned that's available for software companies. You can use this and it frees up your software development team to do the things that you need to do in-house instead of competing for time and resources to do something that's not necessarily, you don't have to reinvent the wheel in. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, factors a little bit into just both efficiency, like you can bring something like Elu on in a week versus waiting for a software team to, you know, it took us a year to build this. It will also take you a year to build this because we know and we, you know, put more resources into this because this is our core product. And also we've spent so much time engaging from a UI UX perspective around what's pleasant and easy for installers to follow and use and all these extra features, like you can download a workflow and execute it offline, that you're not going to be able to do that with your software development team. So it's really this, you know, why wait and reinvent the wheel on something that we can do probably in a better way?
Do you imagine a scenario in the near or distant future where OEMs clamor to use Elu because it serves as well as a potential channel opportunity?
Yeah. I think so. I think the thing that's quite exciting to me and where we want to go by acting as kind of the clearinghouse between OEMs and installers, then we also set up other opportunities to introduce OEMs to installers, right? Now that we have a pool of installers on our platform and make that more easy to manage. And I think that is a huge opportunity. And also, introduce OEMs to installers, introduce installers to OEMs.
Right.
I think there's a lot of value in that. And just being, I think there's other platforms that do this, that help OEMs on the installers and help be a matchmaker. Doing that, you know, I think the exciting thing about what we can do is now we have a lot more data and information, right, about the installer, about the OEM. Say this particular installer has been great at installing similar batteries, and this is, they're in the particular geography that you're trying to go into and they have capacity. It makes that a lot more bespoke and powerful rather than kind of a simple matchmake.
I mentioned earlier, obviously, you've won the American Made Solar Prize. What other sort of accolades and non-dilutive capital have you achieved? What sort of milestones for product development would you want to highlight before we dig into sort of how this all came together?
Yeah. So in addition to the American Made Solar Prize, which was kind of three stages, ready, set, and go. And we were lucky to kind of win the kind of grand prize in the software category for that. Now, a year and a half ago, we've also won the Energizing Rural Communities Prize, also with the Department of Energy. I think one of the capabilities that I think is quite exciting that we've been bringing on is with something like Elu, with these digital workflows, instead of sending a engineer quite far into the field for these remote communities, they can send a workflow or send something digitally for someone local to take all the photos, get all the documentation. So when the engineer actually goes, they already have an idea what's wrong. They already have the spare parts. They can make that much more efficient. So this is the feature set that was recognized through the Energizing Rural Communities Prize this year. I think in addition to that, we've been lucky to be supported by the Wesley Foundation, Steve Wesley's fund, and he has worked with kind of Procore and a number of kind of software products in the space. And we've also been supported by kind of the Belgian government, mostly, you know, because we provided our software to other emerging markets, developing countries that they support and the type of, you know, energy infrastructure that they support.
As we enter into a new era of grid parity, lowering LCOE cost on commercial solar projects has never been more critical. Recently, Trina Solar's TopCon 700-watt Vertex N module was awarded a bankability report by UL Solutions, proving exactly 5.8% reduction in LCOE compared to other N-type modules. Just one more reason Trina Solar is your trusted partner for total solar solutions. Visit mysuncast.com/Trina to see how a Trina Solar Vertex module can save you money today. Hey, pardon the interruption, but I wanted to just let you know how much of an impact you have on Suncast. Yeah, you. Thank you for clicking play. Without you, this show is just me shouting into the void. But there's still people who don't even know about Suncast. I know. I can hardly believe it myself. But that's where you can help me yet again. There's a simple way that you can show some love and help others discover the show. If you cruise over to www.ratethispodcast.com/suncast, I'd love it if you would leave a 5-star rating and enthusiastic review. That's possibly the single kindest thing that you could do for me today. So if the show has helped, inspired, or even entertained you at all, I'd love it if you would head over to ratethispodcast.com/suncast and give me a virtual 2 thumbs up. All right, back to today's episode. Do you remember the first time you realized that you had an inkling of an idea towards energy and new forms of energy, or being even aware of environmental activism as a potential pathway for life?
Yeah, I think I recognized that quite early. I remember watching Inconvenient Truth. I think I was in fourth grade and being very impacted by that movie and wanting to do something about it, just recognizing that as a drive, as a mission. I think I first started hearing about what essentially is distributed solar in middle school, I think 7th or 8th grade, and just thinking it was such cool technology. I think I was specifically stumbled upon what were in our solar home systems for communities without electricity. And I think, for someone who's quite passionate about climate and sustainability, but also quite passionate about, international development and just development, a lot of times those two things are in conflict with each other, right? A lot of sustainability is use less, development is do more, use more. And I remember coming across the idea of distributed solar for solving energy poverty and for energy access as, wow, this is something that does more. It creates opportunities. It lets people, tap into the awesomeness of electricity to move everything faster and build everything faster and do cooler things and exchange information, but is also a kind of climate friendly and sustainable way to do that.
So you mentioned around middle school sort of discovering distributed generation, distributed solar. How did you first engage with that? And also perhaps maybe introduce how and where you first met Natasha, your high school friend who's now your co-founder.
In middle school, I found and probably stumbled upon a kind of newly formed nonprofit in Palo Alto called 1 Million Lights, which had the goal of replacing dangerous kerosene lamps in kind of rural and kind of energy poor places across the world with solar lighting. And I thought that was such a cool thing to do and kind of wanted to kind of go and help make this happen. And around the same time, I pulled in one of my best friends, Natasha, who, we've gone through this whole journey together, and she's now my co-founder at ELU, and was just excitedly telling her about, solar and 1 Million Lights. And she got really excited about it too. And the two of us kind of, from the very beginning, wanted to do this together. So starting with, I think, you know, small solar lights, and, you know, we were started engaging with it, just knocking door to door, trying to raise money. We sold.
In your neighborhood.
In my neighborhood.
Yeah, a teenager. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think we were, you know, 13, 14, just think this is awesome. And I don't know, selling cupcakes at the school and, I don't know, selling chocolates. And I was really lucky to have met some, you know, now really great friends at a what's called Global Youth Leaders Conference in Washington, D.C., I think the summer after my freshman year in high school. And they were from all across the world. And in particular, some were from the Philippines, which, you know, was and is still dealing with, you know, issues with energy access. It's hard with all the islands. And we worked together to bring solar lights in the Philippines. And that's how we got started with that.
That's amazing. So I'm going to fast forward. You graduated high school, got through college. You had obviously exhibited these early signs of entrepreneurship, but chose not to go into entrepreneurship. Talk to me about the career direction that ultimately led to you and Natasha going apart for a while.
Yeah, I think I really liked the work that we were doing with 1 Million Lights, but I also knew that I wouldn't be happy doing this purely as a nonprofit or as philanthropy. I think I feel very strongly around, you know, building a business that is scalable and will almost generate momentum. I like this idea where it will scale because it builds upon itself in a kind of very real way. So I, you know, came out, I was still working on energy access projects in college. And I think I was trying to figure out, you know, I feel really passionate about this. What are the biggest hurdles and challenges I think is facing energy access and or preventing us from building microgrids and deploying solar and storage everywhere? And I knew there were two things. One was financing, and the second was workforce development. And I think even in high school, I identified those two as particular difficulties. And Natasha and I had talked over it when we met up in the summers. And I chose to tackle the first one. I was like, if I needed to know how to tackle this finance problem, I should know how the finance world works. What's the best place to learn that? That is at Morgan Stanley, specifically in the team that finances the largest and most complicated energy and infrastructure projects around the world, because I can learn that mental model of how people assess whether something is financeable or not. So that led me down the particular career path I chose going out of college. And, you know, also Morgan Stanley has a great reputation. They're the smartest guys on the street doing exactly this. So really, really learned a lot. And I think in terms of diverging with Natasha, we were talking about these two problems, and she focused on workforce development in particular, the other hurdle, and she focused on solar training. She was a Watson Fellow at the college, which funded her to travel to Cambodia and Myanmar and East Africa, Uganda, Rwanda area, to explore specifically capacity building in these type of industries and grassroots
capacity, like the workforce development side of it.
And so
what did you two study in undergrad as a core skill?
I studied economics and environmental science in undergrad, and Natasha studied physics and did a lot of engineering.
So physics and engineering and economics come together. This is great.
You
are, while Natasha is beginning to get out into the world and learn where there are strengths and weaknesses, how these energy systems work together, You're on the street. You're at Morgan Stanley learning to finance large-scale infrastructure. How critical do you feel the skills you learned there were to what you're doing today? And what was it that, when you look at the work you did at Morgan Stanley, really helped prepare you, not just as an entrepreneur, but for the world of integrating a software product into the energy sector?
Yeah, I think the work at Morgan Stanley really taught me to be disciplined and structured in how I evaluate businesses and business models and risks to those businesses, various scenarios. I think, you know, a lot of people look at something and they see like that's a risk, but it's not necessarily quantified. It's, you know, right. If we were building a wind farm in Texas, we would actually model out, you know, if a hurricane hit, what exactly would the financial damage be?
Right.
And I think that was a really good skill to learn and something that I apply all the time when I am evaluating a business opportunity or a potential pivot or a direction that we're going down. How do you make that concrete and think about probabilities and numbers and kind of risk that perspective to help you inform decisions? So I think that's very much what I took away from it. I think the other one is learning to identify and have a mental map of all the stakeholders and players in a particular project, because these are quite, you know, quite complicated, and different people have different roles. And I think a big part of being a project finance banker is trying to clarify where the liabilities are, where the steps to remedy any kind of issue. And I think that really gave me an initial picture as someone who, you know, right out of college and kind of very young, of the particular type of finger pointing that might happen between the different entities that's building a project or developing something together. And we spent so much time on it. And in particular, you know, these large projects spent a lot of time negotiating contracts that's like, in these scenarios, it's the fault of the EPC. In these scenarios, it's fault of the OEM. In these scenarios, this is a damage that, you know, now the financing party has to handle.
And it's really, really evaluating who's the roles and responsibilities along the value chain.
Yeah. And allocating it in a, you know, in a clear way. And I think that really helped both in Myanmar, where we're actually a project developer. So that was quite close to the, you know, skill set that I had learned at Morgan Stanley, but also now, where I think there's a particular insight that we had gotten around, you know, the relationship between installers and manufacturers, which is very much supportive partnership, but there are some potential conflicts in there, and it helps everyone to be able to clarify that and, you know, allow that to be streamlined, which is, I think, something that I got a little inkling from, you know, at Morgan Stanley.
Natasha, I'm curious, before we jump into the recombining of efforts and what took you to Myanmar, do you now feel like the finance was the bottleneck, and that the time you went and spent at Morgan Stanley was resolved? You were able to put that into work in helping solve climate change?
Yeah, I think this was actually very much of a process and a realization when I was in Myanmar. I think I had so thrown myself at financing as a key bottleneck for deployment in this industry, which I still think it is. But when we were building our projects in Myanmar, financing, you know, was a challenge, but it wasn't the ultimate challenge. The ultimate challenge was managing the team, training up the team, figuring out what the processes are. And I think it took my ego a while to be like, Natasha, you were right on focusing the other problem. This is our bigger headache that we should focus on. And it was a bit of a rude awakening for me. That's, you know, I think this is more impactful for us to spend our time solving.
Why don't we take a minute and explain to folks what you and I have been alluding to all along, which is how you and Natasha ended up coming back together. We mentioned you both went to college, you separated sort of divide and conquer in terms of skills building. She went off to Myanmar, which you mentioned, and you were in Morgan Stanley financing $10+ billion worth of infrastructure. Talk about the decision to leave Morgan Stanley and what that led to. Yeah.
I think while I was there, I always had an eye on, you know, what Natasha was doing, what was happening in terms of both technology and policy, and what opportunities there could be to lead me back into, you know, building my own thing, which I felt really strongly about, and also back into kind of distributed energy and distributed solar in particular versus kind of large centralized infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The particular opportunity that came up came from a combination of things. First, when Natasha was in Myanmar, from a very personal perspective, when she was in Myanmar, I went and visited her and spent some time there. And both of us really fell in love with the country and we loved Yangon. And there's just such energy there and in a way that we both loved, like a sense of possibility. And people are entrepreneurial, but also kind of kind and generous. So that's, you know, from a personal perspective, that was one of the reasons why I was so comfortable leaving and kind of moving halfway across the world to do this. I think the other one is the timing worked out very well, in that there was a big kind of World Bank funded subsidy program in Myanmar specifically towards distributed solar and specifically towards microgrids. And from my perspective, I'd been kind of excitedly following the development of microgrids and kind of larger scale solar and storage systems, you know, because I started off in very small solar home systems and even solar lights. And I thought kind of this larger scale was kind of more cool and more impactful. And I think I helped on an Asian Development Bank grant on microgrids back in 2014 in one of my summers, but then was like, I want to do something with microgrids and see where they can go. So when this World Bank kind of subsidy program came out in Myanmar, that was a really exciting opportunity to pursue that. And then also having worked in the Philippines, Indonesia, Cambodia with 1 Million Lights, I think I was always aware of Myanmar as a potential, you know, it was always just this black hole because there's so little information and it was completely closed. And so when it opened up, that was really exciting. And then there's just such opportunity. There's 30 million people there without electricity, which is huge. The entire south of the country has
What percentage connection. Of the population is that?
Around 50%.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no connection, just centralized electricity. The entire south of the country is essentially run off diesel generators, which is pretty insane. There's a lot of kind of, you know, from Natasha's perspective, why she was there is she found it fascinating that there were 13,000 diesel microgrids working already in Myanmar because it, you know, powered the entire south of the country. And I think there was a particular interesting and unique part about Myanmar that usually when you go to places without any electrical access, they're very poor. And then you're educating people about what electricity is and how you could use it. That wasn't the case. Myanmar was just, they already knew they had diesel generators. They knew, you know, they were already using it. They had kind of this sense and they just didn't have the technology to, and, you know, in my head, solar and storage is such an obviously better technology. It's cheaper than diesel. Right. It's clean. It's more reliable. You can run it 24/7 because instead of a diesel generator that's just on and off, you can actually, you know, slowly pull down on the battery capacity. And it just seemed, you know, so that kind of tickled my finance brain of like, this makes sense. Like the models, you know, say this makes sense. Mm-hmm. And all that combination and the fact that Natasha had already been there and built up a network and had learned so much about it and kind of de-risked it kind of for me to go.
Yeah.
That really, you know, was what kind of gave me the final push to kind of go on and pursue this.
And you've spent 4 years figuring out how to bring money to bear. So if we could just get the money, then the rest will just fall in line, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I'm so proud. I mean, the team is still operating there. We're still doing projects there. The systems that we built and service are still operating. But it was hard.
Turns out raising the money isn't the hard part.
Yeah, exactly.
The hard part is running the play on the ground, like getting those projects up and running, getting the products in the hands of people who have not installed a refrigerator, much less a solar microgrid. And so you started building these processes. Two young Silicon Valley tech entrepreneurs building energy assets in Myanmar. For those who are unfamiliar, for what it's worth, Myanmar is formerly Burma, near Thailand, Vietnam, sort of in the Nepal, Thailand, Vietnam area. I don't presume that many would need to know that, but I can imagine that some are kind of wondering in their heads, like, where is Myanmar? I'm feeling a little insecure here. It's like on the other side of India. So, and what we know is Myanmar's terribly hard as are many developing nations to build and maintain a business. At some point, you ran into enough roadblocks to necessitate finding an alternative financial plan for your young adult entrepreneurial venture. As you and Natasha were assessing the sort of the resources, the assets that you'd created, how did the product of Elu surface as the thing that you had built that would be the path forward?
So what made us leave Myanmar was the military coup in 2020, which was, double whammy of COVID and the military coup, which was kind of very tough. And two of us came back to the U.S. after that. I think as we were assessing things, we had started building up a software tool, a step-by-step guidance tool for our field teams, seeing some of the difficulties we had around kind of commissioning and quality assurance on the ground with these systems. And we were kind of big believers in it, in that we were shocked at how hard Salesforce Field Services to use. We couldn't get Asana and these other things to use. And we were kind of surprised that nothing like Elu had, we couldn't find something like Elu just off the shelf.
Yeah.
So we were, of course, just big believers in the utility of the thing we were building, because we were kind of directly bumping our heads or hitting our heads against the wall on the problem. I think, from the start, when we were back in the U.S. and trying to figure out, if Myanmar was going to go back to normal and we can go back and kind of continue what we were doing, or needed to figure something else, we were just talking to people around building out a software product. And the feedback was generally kind of very positive. We had some kind of early believers that were saying, like, wow, this is kind of awesome. We got a kind of $20,000 contract from DGRV, kind of the German development agency that we were working with, specifically to implement, the early, I hesitate to even call it Elu because it was such an early little prototype, specific prototype of it on their projects, which was, a kind of big win for us and validated some of this. And I think, we got some attention from, mentors who were familiar with the American Made Solar program, the Department of Energy kind of software support and funding programs, that really said, you guys should look at this. I think this is a problem in the U.S. as well. And I think from our perspective, we weren't initially thinking about this for the developed world or, for the U.S. at all. Yeah. I think similarly to how we were surprised that other software platforms didn't work for our needs in Myanmar, we had kind of assumed that someone else would have figured it out, especially like in the US.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of taking with a grain of salt all these mentors who said, like, go apply for these American, you know, go look at the US market, go apply for these programs. And it was really going through the American Made Solar kind of program and ultimately winning that prize, like that whole year-long process of slowly building it out and, you know, exploring and talking to lots and lots of people about this, that gave us kind of the confidence to even pursue it in this market. And also kind of figure out exactly where we sit. Like, who do we sell to? Do we sell to an installer? Do we sell to the OEM? So that's been kind of a lengthy process for us to figure out. And I think, you know, we're finally at the point where, you know, we figured out, you know, exactly the pain point who we're going for and what's the kind of most efficient way of getting this out.
How did the process of going through initially the American Made Solar Prize refine the idea? Where can you talk about where it started, where you kind of had it as a product, the beginning of that process versus where it is now?
I think at the very beginning of the process, we had a pretty scattered kind of product in terms of features, because we were building something that we just needed on the ground. So it had little modules for managing inventory, it had modules for payments, it had modules for procedures. And I think that's, you know, what happens where you're just kind of coding little things. That's like, oh, we need something to do this. Like, let's build this in. And I think going through that process was very much refining kind of what the most important part of all of that is.
Yeah.
And what is something that is kind of particularly unique, which is the procedure side. I think the other thing that it helped us refine and was something that we knew was difficult, but, you know, we were developers. We were working closely with the OEM to build out the commissioning process, but we weren't the OEM. We just knew we wanted our field techs to have these processes digitally.
Right.
So at first, we imagined selling this to kind of other developers and installers, similar profile size,
right,
who
the commissioning process.
The commissioning, yeah. We really found the commissioning process to be kind of the toughest when we were in Myanmar, but kind of install and commissioning, I guess. But it was really time intensive to build this out as an installer, because we weren't installing that many systems.
Yeah.
Very few people have kind of the time and energy to build this out. They think it would be very nice to have them, but that initial investment was difficult to justify.
Yeah.
And I think going through the program and just, you know, trying to figure out who would put in kind of the energy and investment, who has the know-how to build those out, which is the manufacturers. And it, you know, it sounds intuitive and obvious now that we've come to this conclusion, but it was not at the very beginning, right? For us, it was, you know, trying to get in front of them and talk to them and figure out the right people in these kind of larger organizations to talk to. So that was a learning process for us.
So you are still pre-seed. You haven't raised any institutional investment. You've done friends and family and been able to bring on, as I understand, a handful of clients who agree that this is a useful process. How then do you spend your time as the CEO? How do you think about continuing to grow this as a software? Traditionally, you know, a company that you're competing with, Asana and ClickUp and Salesforce, raised hundreds of millions of dollars to get to the point where they have, where they're at product market fit, they're at revenue, they're break even. Talk to me about that process for you and the time that how you're spending your time right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, Natasha and I are our co-CEOs. We also have Tracy on the team who leads the technology side of things. But we're very much all hands on deck. Like, I'm also coding. I'm obviously doing marketing and sales.
Wow.
And you know, also strategizing from a product perspective. I think we've been quite disciplined with ourselves as, you know, we don't want to go out and raise until we're very confident about this business model and the particular angle that we're hitting, our go-to-market strategy and, you know, how we make this work. We don't really want to just sell a story.
Right.
And I think that's related to, you know, Natasha, I didn't go to this because we wanted to be like some ego-driven large software founder kind of vibe. We're building this because we think this product should exist in the world and the world will be better, right? Or you know, at least an energy transition would be easier with this, and there's value in that. So I think that has kind of led some of our decisions around, you know, how we fund and how we kind of explore and kind of build the product so far. I think we're at a point now with the OEMs that we have on their platform and the feedback from both them and the installers that we do have that, you know, confidence. And I think we're very much at the point where we want to get more resources and fundraise and capitalize up to both build out our software team to build out the cool features, additional cool features that we really want to include. And a lot of that is how do we make this kind of both a overall way for the OEMs to manage their installers, right? Like this is almost a CRM for them to track who their installers are, what they're doing.
Right.
And the second one from a kind of technology perspective is how do we automate more of this? We have this data of like who the installer is, what they've done before, what equipment they're now installing and where they are. How do we automatically tell them what workflows they should follow instead of them having to search, right? And
right.
Or be assigned the right ones. And I think there's a lot of power to that. So we definitely want to build up our product and software team to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And then the other side is building up more structure from a sales and marketing organization side versus, you know, Natasha and I think we've been able to do a lot with the two of us. But I really like the idea of kind of building up also, you know, streamlining processes. This is the product that we're building.
Yeah.
And we love that. We want to also do that for ourselves and build out the team to do that.
As a young entrepreneur trying to get to that next step in the process, where's the friction for you right now, in particular on the market side?
Yeah. So I think the friction now, it's always going to be hardest to get the initial buy-in and the first kind of people who say, kind of, I believe in this. And I think we get so much feedback that like, this is so cool, but people do have a bit of a kind of lemmings mentality that says, which kind of marquee?
Yeah. Who am I following?
Who am I following? I think that's a common challenge to any type of, you know, startup, and especially on the enterprise and startup selling to enterprises. And I think we're just kind of getting over that initial hurdle with the people who are coming on board, which will help a lot. I think the other one is, you know, Natasha and I don't necessarily, we're not in the old boys club, right?
Yeah.
That is very much this industry. And I recognize that as a one disadvantage that we have. And I think, you know, building up, one is actually building up our own networks and working with kind of great advisors who have been so helpful to be able to do that. And the other part of that is building up a sales team that already come with that network, which gets them more time in front of the specific personas and people that you need them to engage, to evaluate. And, you know, that's the challenge that we're working on, kind of focusing on solving at the moment.
As someone who's grown up in Silicon Valley and the culture therein, both from an entrepreneurial perspective, but a tech-heavy sort of platform, a lot of the decisions that I see you engaging in, they aren't surprising. I'm really appreciating how well you seem to have executed on them in a lightweight, capital-intensive-wise speaking way. Yeah, and also from a human capital perspective, right? You guys are a relatively small team. How do you surround yourself with the right kinds of people so that you, even with a small team and even with a shoestring budget, are still achieving milestones that companies many times your size are struggling with?
I think I'm so lucky to be, you know, in San Francisco, I think, and in, you know, I live in a community house of people working on climate, which has...
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, which has multiple kind of founders within it. And I think that is so motivating to have. And I think, you know, it is a little bit of a San Francisco kind of hackery mentality. I hesitate to even use that word, of being able to do a lot with kind of few resources.
Oh, yeah. This is a badge.
Yeah. But I think that's a big part of my, I think, motivation, because founding a startup, growing this, leading it, staying motivated through it is not easy. And I think without a community of similar-minded people also doing hard things, daring to do hard things, it's, you know, almost impossible to do that.
Does Natasha also live there?
Natasha is actually now based in Thailand, I think.
Oh, wow. She stayed over there. Okay.
Very remote. She was back here for a while, back in California for a while, and kind of decided to go back to Southeast Asia. But I think that's a community also that has that, right? The expat. Yeah. I think we very much got so much motivation from our community in Myanmar. And I think she has a similar thing in Thailand, of people, I think, more closely engaging with the needs, kind of many of these needs that otherwise I think is easy to just take for granted. And I think that's very motivating. Yeah, I think for me, being in, I've really loved kind of the San Francisco climate tech community and the motivation. I think, you know, talking about engaging with big problems, I think we do talk about, you know, the climate crisis. We do talk about, you know, the need to deploy as quickly as we can to solve that. And that kind of recenters you to, you know, be able to put your all into kind of building something, because it does feel like you're part of, you know, this bigger movement solving a very important thing.
Sierra, as we begin to round out the conversation here and sort of head towards home base, as it were, I have a few questions that I hope might be helpful for folks that are listening who maybe are looking at you and Natasha as inspiration, peer mentors, as it were. They also want to get into climate, perhaps even into solar. Are there any particular areas where you would direct people's attention in terms of deep sort of structural need in the industry that is still unmet? And or is there any other sort of career starting advice that occurs to you that in the last, you know, 5 or so years you wish you'd known, or resources you wish you had? I invite you to share those now.
Yeah. I think there's these, starting from the last bit of your question, which is resources or kind of things to know, there's such great communities in this space. And I think one of the things I love most about working in, you know, climate tech or kind of solar or even kind of distributed energy is how cool the people are and how great the communities are. Yeah. I want to kind of shout out a couple of these. I think Work on Climate is awesome. It's run by actually one of my housemates, specifically helping people mostly in tech kind of transition in into more meaningful climate careers.
Is that workonclimate.org?
Yeah, workonclimate.org.
Okay.
My Climate Journey is a great resource. Kind of provides similar benefits and kind of similar community. On the energy side, Distributed Energy Resources Task Force, DRTF, is a awesome kind of community that I think was the first kind of group I tapped into when I came back to the Bay Area from Myanmar. And, you know, these communities are all over the U.S., not just kind of San Francisco and the Bay Area. And they also make some great swag. I have a sweatshirt that says microgrids are dope that came from DRTF.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah.
And I think the American-made network, so all the resources related to the Department of Energy and the funding programs that they do for new innovation have been really supportive as well. So I think if you have an eye on getting into climate or being a founder, these are probably, you know, the most high-value communities that you can tap into for, you know, direction, for advice, for motivation, camaraderie, right? And I would highly, highly recommend these. I think in terms of directions to go into, at least kind of from where I sit in San Francisco and climate tech, I think there's, you know, a lot of people might think about climate tech as, you know, a lot of deep technology, deep tech, right? There's the kind of cool, like, technical innovations to solve the climate challenge, which I think are awesome. But I do think kind of little issues like deployment and the actual work that it needs to get these technologies on the ground, which is, you know, Elu's working at it from a particular perspective, but there's other challenges that fall into this category. I think those are still overlooked. I think workforce development is a big part of it. And I think there's maybe a, you know, conception of these challenges as like less sexy than something that pulls carbon dioxide out of the air, for example. But I think we are very much at the stage where I think, you know, deploy, solving these small kind of on the ground hurdles and issues is probably one of the most impactful things that you can do. So talking about people wanting to kind of contribute to climate, would highly recommend kind of taking a deeper look at these.
Along that line, are there any kind of essential reading resources that you consider helpful? Or if not, or failing that, books that have inspired you that you'd like to share along with our readers, with our listeners?
Yeah. I think I absolutely love The Overstory by Richard Powers. It's a book about trees, I guess, fiction book of interweaving of different people's relationship to trees that I really enjoyed. And I think, you know, one thing about living in this house is we're all quite kind of outdoorsy people. And I think a connection with nature is very motivational when trying to kind of work on these sets of problems. So
yeah.
Overstory, I highly recommend. I think Braiding Sweetgrass.
Oh boy, I love it.
Similar vein.
Yeah, King Solver is a gem.
Yeah, I think some other books I would recommend. I, you know, as an energy nerd, and I just kind of love thinking about that, I think Daniel Yergin's books, The Prize and The Quest, I think are pretty essential reading about, you know, the geopolitical and just overall kind of world history shaping impact of energy. And I see ourselves in kind of the energy transition going through a pretty critical phase. And I think those books really help set the stage for understanding why this is important, right? And understanding how much this all touches.
Very true. Yeah. I will link to Daniel Yergin is one of my personal heroes. He's as we speak, he's getting ready to go on a week's worth of I guess he's like the industry spokesperson for the energy sector in that regard. He's one of the guys that kind of puts together this thing called CERAWeek down in Houston. And he just has the privilege, which as someone who's built a podcast around this very topic, like he has the privilege of sitting on stage and interacting with world leaders and major business tycoons that are moving the energy sector across all domains, from renewables to, in particular, oil and gas. CERAWeek was traditionally an oil and gas conference. And he's there right in the middle of it. I hope that I actually get to meet him someday. So if you're listening to this and you can make an intro to Daniel Juergen, both Sierra and I would be grateful. I'll make sure that we link to those, to both Daniel's author page on Amazon, so folks can find all those books, as well as the other Barbara Kingsolver is a fan favorite, a family favorite in our family. And Braiding Sweetgrass is one of my kids, my middle kid's favorite books. I have never heard of The Overstory, so definitely going to check that one out. Sierra, I'm grateful for the amount of time we've been able to spend together today. And I'm sure there are more than a handful of folks are going to want to know how they can connect with you personally. Where do you like to be found?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm sure you can add a link somewhere.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to check out ELU, we're at www.elu.works. And there's contact methods on there as well.
Fantastic. ELU, ILLU.works. Let's end today as we usually do with something akin to a bold prediction. Sierra, as we look out over what for you will still be only maybe half of your career, but the next 15, 20 years, and we think about unlocking these big, hairy, audacious goals of climate, keeping our global warming to 1.5°C, of reaching a decarbonized grid or anything remotely similar to 80% renewables. What did we unlock? What did we get right that currently stands in our way?
I think, you know, this transition will change quite a bit of how frontline work is done. I think fundamentally, I think my bold prediction is this type of frontline kind of installation, commissioning, servicing will go through the same kind of fundamental transition that GPS and Google Maps brought to driving. So, you know, you take the London cabbies example where, you know, they spent 10 years memorizing the streets of London, and you can now just get that through your phone on step-by-step directions. I think the same thing will happen in and be driven by the energy transition now that we're installing these modularized things and bring up the workforce to be able to do it. You know, this will probably not be immediate. This will be kind of a decades long transition, but that's where I see us going.
Well, as we head there, we'll be covering it here on Suncast. I want to thank you, Sierra Fan, co-founder and co-CEO of ELU. You can find out more at ELU.works. And we hope to see much more of you and Natasha in the years to come. Thank you for joining us on Suncast.
Thanks for having me.
I love my job. It's such a joy and a pleasure to bring conversations like the one we just had with Sierra Fan to you. And thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to pay attention all the way through this episode. I hope that you've learned something. I'm very sure that if you're still watching here, you have, and you're taking away some gems, some nuggets of wisdom. I want to leave you with one more, and I think it's worth considering. In a world, as Sierra pointed out, that's more aligned with the old boys club, women like Sierra and Natasha are often not taken seriously, not given the credibility they deserve. So I ask you to ponder this one interesting fact. We mentioned that Sierra had started thinking about working on, in fact, raising money for and distributing LED lights in her teens. That year was 2006. And I, as a recent grad school graduate and fresh minted MBA, started my first solar company in 2006. Prior to that, I had not even really the thought of or desire to be in the solar industry. So you see, we often misconstrue age with wisdom or experience. And much as Zuckerberg started Facebook long before he was in his college dorm room, he started it with the nuts and bolts, the practical work of learning to code and learn and beginning to think as he did about software and how it would change the world. Sierra and Natasha began thinking about changing the world long before they built their business in Myanmar or their software, Ilu. My hat's off to these two young, budding entrepreneurs. I hope that you enjoy this conversation with them, that you'll continue to rally around and support the women that are helping shoulder the burden of the energy transition. We have so many smart, capable people who want to see this world change in positive ways. They want to see us wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. And that's what we try to do each and every week here on Suncast, is to bring you glimpses into the reality of these clean energy leaders on the front lines of the energy transition. If you'd like to join us as a guest on the show, please let us know. You can email the team at podcast@suncast.me. You can also reach out to me on LinkedIn or X. All of the ways to do that are in the description either below me here on YouTube or on the podcast app that you're listening to. If you would take a moment and subscribe to the show, that lets others know that we do have listeners that say, yes, I'm faithful to Suncast. I tune in regularly. And if this is your first time, man, I hope that we've earned that rating, review, like, subscribe, however you choose to engage. Or just come back and test the waters again next time. We're here every Tuesday and Thursday. Thanks to our sponsors, you only have to pay your time and attention. They do the rest. You can find out more about the services they offer at mysuncast.com/sponsor. It's also how you can learn ways to partner with us to reach thousands of solar warriors and climate champions just like they do each and every week. I'm honored that you're here. Remember, you are what you listen to. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warrior. It's half the battle.